So what is so beautiful about Bitcoin in that sense is the engineering that went into it and the building blocks that were found over the course of decades and that slowly, you know, little by little, they were integrated. And then with new innovations on top of it. So you have the difficulty adjustment, but Satoshi was able to integrate everything into this perfectly tuned system that just keeps on working. And that's just mind blowing from an engineering perspective.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. This is a podcast all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the people converging on this new form of money. Why do they see value in it? What skills enable their understanding? How is it changing their lives? If you're a founder looking for funding or an investor looking to make investments, then please reach out as I develop my network in the space. Do me a favor and chuck us a 5-star rating on whichever app you're using to listen, or a like if you're watching it somewhere. As insignificant as this may seem, they help a startup project like this hugely. Lastly, if you have any questions at all, please just reach out. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Jake E.S. Woodhouse. Now, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk about our sponsor. Fast Bitcoins are a Bitcoin exchange who you should definitely take a look at next time you're thinking of making a Bitcoin purchase. They're a great team, which for me is always the key to due diligence, whilst their product has a ton of features useful to every Bitcoiner. Check out my episodes with Danny Brewster, the founder CEO, and Nathan Smith, the chief compliance officer, to learn more about the people behind the brand. Thank you to Fast Bitcoins for sponsoring the show. Now, on to today's episode. Today, I'm speaking with David De Silva Rosa. Hey, David, how are you?
Doing fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I recently came across a couple of your YouTube videos as I was researching El Salvador and looking at what was going on there, and really excited to have you on the podcast today and hear about, you know, the decision-making process you've been through, basically. And we're at a similar stage in our lives. I've got small babies and trying to work out what the hell to do with ourselves. We'll get to that as the conversation goes on, but I always start in the same place. So if you can wind the clock back, where were you? What were you doing in your life? And what was going on in general when Bitcoin came into it?
When Bitcoin came into my life, that's a long time ago. I do have proof of the very first email that a university friend sent to me. He was a computer science engineering student. So he was on all of the forums and all of the, you know, the geek news. And he got wind of Bitcoin the first. And he sent it to a group of friends, including me. And I still have the reply of that, where I sent him a reply. where I basically told him, like, that's not going to work. And this is back in, I think, 2011. So, wow. You know, most people need multiple touch points. And the same was true for me. So I only started taking it a little bit more seriously in 2013. Mm-hmm. I've tried to buy some. I don't really remember what platform I used. But what I do remember from that time is that same computer science friend was a very good hacker. And he was basically able to get into the online casinos. Bitcoin was being used on these Bitcoin casinos, and he was trying to find the hacks. You know, he was trying to empty their Bitcoin wallets. And so before you knew it, he had a bunch of Bitcoin sitting in his wallet, and we were spending it at the university bar. You know, there was a bar in the town, and he was taking us out to have these drinks. And at around the same time, 2013, there was this delivery company called Thuisbezorgd in the Netherlands, where I was studying, and it's the equivalent of Just Eat. And so it allows you to order food at all these different restaurants. And so as a publicity stunt, this company had started accepting Bitcoin payments, because that was a very easy way for them to get into the news, you know, get picked up. Although almost no one was using Bitcoin, it was, you know, fun and interesting. So my friend, he was so good with his Bitcoin wallet, he figured out how to do double spend attack. So we would come together on Friday afternoon with a bunch of friends at his house, and we would get, you know, we would order pizza and ice cream and everything, and it would just get delivered. And meanwhile, he would send the Bitcoin to their wallet, but before it got confirmed, he would send it back to his own wallet. Wow. And so he didn't pay anything for that. Yeah. I'm not in touch with this university friend anymore, but I didn't take Bitcoin seriously at that point of time. It was really a geeky, fun thing, you know, internet culture. It wasn't something I was thinking through. It wasn't something I was believing could have big impacts on the world, could change, you know, the financial system and all of that. No. So that took me a few years later to 2017, where we had another run up. all the altcoins, the shit coins, the casino. Like I was attracted to that when I was kind of in a boring phase of my studies. And then I started taking it more seriously after getting wrecked in the shitcoin market, basically. So maybe that's a good way to summarize.
Wow. It's so cool, isn't it? Because your point about multiple touch points is absolutely correct. And I'm the same. And anyone that's got this far down the Bitcoin rabbit hole has had a similar process. One thing I'd like to talk through. So when I lived in London last, so around 2017, actually, I was looking at startups. And there is a university in London called Imperial College, a very strong kind of technology-based college. I had a bunch of friends out of there that were developing different things. And I heard of University Delft through them, which I believe is where you were studying. And it was
correct.
You know, one of the leading schools in Europe that I'd frankly never heard of. But to me, it's like the equivalent of Imperial College, but in the Netherlands. So your computer science friend would be one of the leading computer scientists in his studies in Europe in that sense. So just talk to me a bit about that environment and what you were personally studying. And what intrigues me is that it will be, for my mind anyway, like, you know, top-notch education, and you're still interested in Bitcoin. Like a lot of people will look, Bitcoin's a scam, it's just for criminals or whatever. But, you know, someone like yourself has been through an elite education program and looks at the technological side of it and still uses it. And that to me is really interesting.
That's a great question, Jake. Yeah. My friend was studying computer science engineering. So at this university, you could, you know, get an engineering degree in almost anything, right? Civil engineering, aerospace engineering, mechanical engineering. I chose to do aerospace engineering mostly because of my failed childhood dream to become a pilot, which was a very bad, you know, as a lot of young boys, it was a very bad time at that time to go into the pilot school, because you would get into a ton of debt from the get-go and you would have basically no guarantee of finding a job. So I decided against that and I was putting it to the side. So I went into aerospace engineering, which I thought would be a good, you know, thing to do in a very similar field. And what if maybe I can become a pilot later on, then it could suit me well. So I never had much difficulty learning in school. You should go through like primary school and then you go to through college. Like you get less smart every time you upgrade, because, you know, in primary school, you're maybe like the brightest or the second brightest in the class. And then you go to, you know, I went to college in France. My parents moved to France when I was 15 years old. So I've lived in France for a few years. And then I decided to go study in the Netherlands. And then when I got to university with all of these aerospace engineering students, suddenly you're not smart anymore at all because you're surrounded by the brightest. So suddenly I was in this environment where I was not smart at all. You know, wow. I was relatively smart, but now there were all these people that were way smarter than I was. And so you had, for instance, you had a 15-year-old, you know, he had skipped, I don't know how many classes to be in that university course together with me. And I was turning 18. So like 3 years or 4 years he skipped, and he would basically ace everything, only get like the highest grades possible. And yeah, so you go to one side of the spectrum where it's like totally geek nerd and very strong with analysis and calculating and just memorizing knowledge. But I, on the other hand, I went through this phase where I lost a lot of confidence because somehow like I was failing, you know, a bunch of courses. And of course there was student life, which was super interesting, and you get to develop yourself in other ways, especially in the Netherlands where there's a very rich student fraternity life. But over the course of time, like I had to come over these hurdles and, you know, regain the confidence. I needed to pass all the mathematics courses to, you know, pass the differential equations and all the flight dynamics courses, like those things that most can struggle with. But this is over the span of 10 years, because I've done extremely long over my studies, which used to be not so uncommon in the Netherlands. Like students used to be able to study for as long as they could, and the state would basically finance everything from A to Z until they had their diploma. And that has changed over the course of time. So like the longer you do your studies, the more you're going to be in debt, or you're going to pay for it on your own. But
well, I think what I was trying to get at, David, is if you have been through this kind of education, it gives you a certain set of tools to analyze situations. And so someone like myself, who is not from an engineering background and doesn't have hundreds of engineering friends, I went through more of an arts focused kind of business school, basically, which is, yes, you can do economics, but it's not, you know, hardcore engineering. So what does that kind of education teach you, and how did that help you understand Bitcoin?
So especially in the engineering field, I think you're very much taught to think in systems, right? You have this term called systems engineering, or especially when you go to the control theory side, where you have a process and you're trying to control it, whether that is the pitch attitude of an airplane, or you're controlling how a vehicle is being steered along a track. Mm-hmm. You're taught how a controller works. So you measure process, and then you compare it to a reference signal. And then depending on what the outcome is of that difference, then you steer left or right, right? I'm simplifying it very much. And then, like, that's the very basic controller, but then you can expand this to way bigger, 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 where you get, at some point you have a huge diagram with all of these blocks, you know, talking to each other and getting feedback from one another. And you're basically tuning, you're deciding the parameters of the controllers so that the system operates exactly as you want it to. Like the plane makes the turn in a coordinated manner. So the passengers don't get, you know, shoved into the side of the airplane, but they can just stay comfortably in their seat, and it is as if nothing is happening. The plane is just, you know, smoothly going in one direction all the time, right? And so with an airplane, you have to control everything. You have to control the pitch roll, and you also, like, the attitude of the plane. Am I turning up and down, left to right, etc. And then you have, like, okay, once you have that, that's the smallest of the control variables that you have. But then you integrate it and you get to, okay, what's the altitude? What is the heading? What is eventually the location where I want to direct my airplane to? And so you start with a very small thing that you want to control. And it's like everything in that airplane, everything in that process needs to be controlled in some way. And then eventually, once you manage to find perfection, then you have a system that operates well, that is very well tuned, and it has all of these dynamic properties that are super interesting to study as an engineer. Mm. And the way you could take that and bring it to something like Bitcoin is very much an engineered system. It is very much the product of humans trying to understand, like, the smallest of processes, and then trying to use these processes as building blocks and trying to build a total system that does exactly what we want it to do and that fulfills a set of functional requirements, right? So we start by designing, okay, it needs to do this, 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 this. You start with a list. This is what my system needs to do. And then you start to find ways in which you can bring a whole integrated set of smaller processes with controls, and you bring it to that state. So what is so beautiful about Bitcoin in that sense is the engineering that went into it and the building blocks that were found over the course of decades. Mm. And that slowly, you know, little by little, they were integrated. And then with new innovations on top of it. So you have the difficulty adjustment, but something like the hashing operation, that was already invented before. And most of the cryptography was already invented before. There is no new cryptography. Almost no new cryptography in Bitcoin, as far as I know. But Satoshi was able to integrate everything into this perfectly tuned system that just keeps on working. And that's just mind-blowing from an engineering perspective.
Wow. And so when you first, like, because obviously 2011, you know, 2013, buying pizzas, whatever, like, you know, a similar phase for me as well, going for university, and there was people buying drugs with Bitcoin. Lots of people got into it from that whole Silk Road phase. But it was still like, you could just pay in cash if you want to get high. Like, you didn't need to do it. So it was still an amusing process in a way. And how things have changed, right? 10 years later, wow. When you first kind of took that lens that you would look at an engineering project with and reapplied it to Bitcoin, like, what did that feel like? Do you suddenly go, oh my God, this is much more powerful than I realized? Perhaps there was a moment where you got, oh, I've got to pay more attention to this. And it could just be price. I mean, that's generally speaking what it is, but.
Absolutely, price, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's all about, you know, the human greed. That's what attracts most people first. Mm. Unless you're one of the people that were already interested in the field to begin with, or one of the people that were already interested in the principle of liberty and freedom, you know, that value. Mm. Because very first people that got into Bitcoin, as they say, like, either you're a cypher nerd, what is it called again? A cypherpunk, right? You're either a cypherpunk or you were a libertarian. Mm-hmm. Although most of them came a little bit later, but libertarian, or you were a drugs user.
Mm.
Right?
It's an interesting bunch, isn't it? Not often found in the same room as each other. Wow. Yeah. And so the price is the kind of key attracting tool, isn't it? But I mean, again, to harp on the slightly the same point, but for me as a non-technologist, to be able to have a conversation with someone like yourself, who is an expert in the engineering space, who's looked at it and says, no, this is legit. It's really important for me when it comes to like gaining more mm-hmm. conviction. Because yes, I'm interested okay. in price, but it's like, well, what's actually behind this thing? How does it work? And sure, I can sit down and read an Andreas Antonopoulos, Mastering Bitcoin book, but I'm still not an engineer. I'll never be able to due diligence the technology behind this in the same way that someone like yourself could. Or if it can't be you, you could speak to someone who definitely could and understand what they're saying to you. And so the explanation you've just given, no one's ever explained to me like that. And that's a really, really helpful way mm-hmm. of thinking through it. You mentioned a few terms that I'd like to dive into that aren't necessarily technology focused. But you talk about liberty and freedom. And this is something that really shines through in some of your YouTube videos that you've made. So what does liberty and freedom mean to you? And why is it important with Bitcoin?
To me personally, freedom means being able to spend my time wherever I want to, with whoever I choose, the location I want. Yeah, it's all of that, right? It's like having total say over what you do with your time, the most scarce resource that you have, like with who are you sharing that? What are you doing? So you have absolute say over that. And there's not someone coming from outside that is saying, no, you have to do exactly what I'm telling you to do. You have to do it in this location. You need to do it in this way. And the more of that you have in a society, like the less freedom there is. And I think I haven't been raised to appreciate this value enough. I think a lot of the freedoms and the liberty that we had, and I'm carefully saying had in the West, they were basically taken for granted. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not a value that I recognize in my parents. Maybe they make certain choices, but when push comes to shove, they are more socially minded, or they think that the interest of the society or of the group as a whole is perhaps more important than that of the individual. And so they don't understand some of the choices that I make in my life, and that is a direct reflection of that. I'm 31 years old right now, so I think growing up I was very much unaware of how different things could be, and I have been shocked at how things have changed quickly over the course of the last 2-3 years. And that has really awakened me, and it has really, shook me in the sense that, okay, that's something we need to stand up against, and we need to, find ways to create freedom individually, and then later as a whole, as a society, to bring us back to that where our human nature wants to be, in a sense where you can have, bodily autonomy, you can have control over your life. And someone is not, stealing your life force away every day, and it is forcing you to keep doing certain things that you otherwise wouldn't want to do. That is how I would look at freedom in that sense.
And I think, so I'm 34, so we're a similar age, and yeah. I've got two babies now. I think you just have the one. So like, very shortly, maybe there'll be a second, but
who knows?
The truth is that our parents, or at least mine, were born in 1960. The very tail end of the boomer generation, if you can even call that boomer. And so, yes, my grandparents were too young to actually actively serve in the Second World War, but that was the last kind of major tectonic shift of power in Europe. And I agree, this isn't something I necessarily studied or thought about much growing up, but has become a lot more relevant, specifically when, I'm based in Melbourne in Australia, and, I was locked in my house for 300 days. It was fucking crazy on behalf of the community. And the decision was being made by a centralized group that clearly had a misaligned incentive to the average person. It was just mm-hmm. madness. Now, well, hang on, what can you do about this? And that's one of the reasons I'm so intrigued to have a conversation with yourself, which is this idea of jurisdictional arbitrage and flag theory. And the fact is, there are places in the world that treat you differently. And where are they? And how do you get there? And what difference does it make if you do go? And where to live is a conversation I regularly have with my wife. And the tendencies of the government of Australia were very, very clearly on show, which was much more autocratic than anyone ever realized possible. Melbourne became essentially a police state overnight. I'm aware of the fact there are genuine police states in the world, and I don't take light of that fact. But to us, at least, it felt like that. And mm-hmm. that's the problem, right? Okay, well, do I agree with this? What can I do about it? So now that this concept of libertarianism and you know, wanting more freedom in your life has become a conversation. What are some of the decisions that you've made that have helped you work towards that goal?
First of all, getting out of a fixed contract employment. Obviously, that's one of the big things that keeps a lot of people, you know, locked in their places. I didn't own any real estate or anything like that I had to sell, but I did build a camper van, which I had to unfortunately let go. So that was very painful. But, you know, to work.
I feel sad for you now. I can hear you saying it. I'm like, the camper van.
My wife and I, we've lived in that camper van for almost 2 years and traveling all through Europe. So. Cool. I was working remotely, before it became popular during the pandemic. That was a very good experience. And that also pushed us to eventually go and move to the tropics, because the winter in the south of Europe, we can say from experience, is still a winter.
Yeah.
And you still have to heat your house if you're somewhere, even in the south of Portugal or Spain. And I really like the prospect of trying a life where you don't have to worry at all about the temperature, because the temperature is just always good.
Yeah.
So that seemed very appealing to us at that stage. But obviously I had to quit my job. And it also, I was working for Ledger, the hardware wallet manufacturer that almost everyone knows in the Bitcoin and crypto space. I've been working there for almost 4 years at that time. And it became time for me to follow my heart and my passion more for Bitcoin, because I felt that Bitcoin was the thing that was, you know, worth my while and worth my time and energy. And I felt like I wasn't spending enough time on that. So in that sense, both like wanting to relocate to the other side of the globe and wanting to focus my energy more on Bitcoin and the adoption of that drove me to eventually letting go of my job. And then selling everything that you have. When we left Europe in February of last year, so that's 2022, we had really nothing left except for a few boxes that we left with loved ones. And the rest just went into our suitcases. So we found ourselves at the airport with two dogs that we were carrying and our not even 1-year-old baby. So that was quite an interesting experience. But at that time, we really felt rushed to do it. We had been thinking. So like I said, we had been thinking about it for a certain time, but the restrictions became so unjust and so, you know, so tense, basically, that we weren't able to go out to restaurants, like, you know, about the restrictions.
So yeah.
We happened to own an RV, a mobile home in a holiday park in the south of France at that time. And there was a common pool and there was a common restaurant in the park. And we were paying for that to be able to use it. But because we couldn't show papers, we weren't able to make use of those. So, and we would look at the RV as our home, basically. So like, it's like, okay, come on. And then the prospect of, okay, there's this CEO of a huge airline in Europe that is openly in the media calling for unvaccinated people not to be able to board planes anymore. And that's when we felt, okay, this is not something we have to do like in a year or in 6 months. We got to get out of here now. And so that's when we like, okay, we're going to sell the camper van this week. Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, then you're making decisions and then it can go very quickly. And before you know it, you find yourselves on the other side of the world and you're basically crying in a hammock and in this beautiful place, right? We were first arrived in Mexico, but I was crying because of all the psychological trauma that you went through, because once you make that decision, you're just acting. And there's no, it gets even crazier because we married on one day and the next day we were on the plane, right? Because we wanted to get that, you know, fixed as well. So you have like a good legal status, you're traveling with a child. So yeah, okay. So none of the romantic stuff, right? So it's just, okay, we just get married. Let's organize this in a week or two. Like it was a little bit more than that, but let's organize this quickly. And
call up your mom and dad. Guys, by the way, we're getting married. No, we're not having a ceremony. Yep, we're leaving.
Right. Right. It was very small. It was like, let's just celebrate at home and it'll be fine. And we told each other, like, we're just leaving on our honeymoon now.
Yeah, cool.
It's very exciting,
though, David. There's sometimes where like you have to put action into into process, right? There's all this talking that goes on. Like sometimes I personally feel like I'm just struggling from a form of inertia. You're like, you know, how bad can it get? Well, it got pretty bad. It's still here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. at what mm-hmm. point is breaking point? And so I had the same problem getting in and out of Australia. If you weren't double vaccinated, you couldn't leave the country or get back in without getting right. permission from the government. My mum wasn't able to come for 2.5 years. She couldn't get in because of not having the correct wow. medical status. Mm-hmm. And so she didn't meet her granddaughter until she was 2 years old. I mean, just crazy stuff where like the state has infringed upon the liberty of its supposed citizens. And everyone's got these constitutions that say freedom of movement in them, but they're just bullshit. Complete
there are exceptions.
Bullshit.
There are exceptions in them. And you'll see if you study closely that it's very easy to find a roundabout way to just infringe on those rights.
Mm. It's very, bad, isn't it?
An actual right is probably one that you can really defend yourself. If it is a right that has to be granted to you, then it's like you can ask yourself the question, is it really a right? If you cannot, you know, defend
okay, this
it.
This is a cool conversation. So develop that a little bit further. What you're talking about is human rights at this point and or the right to do something. Just explain a little further what you mean.
Well, what if you have to ask permission of someone to do something, still, if it's like written in some law, like, is that really a right? If you still have to ask permission, or if someone has to, you know, give you the okay on that. So you don't have the right to your, you could say the money in the bank is yours, but you actually don't legally own the money in the bank at all. Mm. So that's what, where it comes back to Bitcoin is like, Bitcoin is permissionless. You don't have to ask anyone permission to use Bitcoin. It's just there for you and you can use it. And you have the tools like running your own node and you have your own private keys. And that is a real right, one that you can defend. Another one would be, you know, you can defend yourself if you're being attacked. If you happen to have firearms or any other way to defend yourself, that is a real right because not only is it written somewhere, but you yourself can enforce it and you don't depend on someone else to enforce it for you, right? So I've also
you mentioned bodily autonomy earlier as well. That would be another obvious area, isn't it? So I have the right to decide what goes into my body,
right? Yeah. Yes, absolutely, yes. And if someone now says, okay, you cannot access certain parts of society unless you inject yourself with this unknown substance, then do you really have a right to, you know, move freely through society and be an equal citizen that can engage in normal parts of the economy
and
or just enjoy a park.
And these are subjects that perhaps our parents didn't have to deal with, like in some ways. So somehow over the last half century, these rights have been slowly chipped away at and chipped away at and chipped away at to suddenly find ourselves in these situations. And as that phrase isn't there, there's nothing more permanent than a government emergency. And that's proving to be true, right? I mean, it's extraordinary how long this whole process has kind of carried on for. David, what I'd love to do is this might be a bit difficult in a way, but you mentioned that you were in a hammock in this beautiful place, but you were in tears.
Yes.
So what the hell was happening there? How did that feel? And what happened after that? Where did the journey take you next?
So this was probably the first week that we were in Mexico. And like I said, I was constantly in, you know, doing mode. You're just action, okay, we have to get here, we have to get there, we have to research this, get organized. And then that moment where you have finally that peace, right, you can finally just settle down, and then you just get over, I got overwhelmed with emotions, and I couldn't like put a finger on what it was exactly, but it was just like, this is a very traumatic experience. And I don't want to say that in a way that I'm acting like a victim or anything, but I can totally sympathize with anyone that feels like they're not safe there where they were born or there where they live, and they have to, you know, from one day to another pick up their stuff and just go out, whether that's for a war or whether that's because you're a political refugee or whatever it is. Like, it doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter how much money you have, like just the uprooting that goes on in that situation where you're taken from your environment where you know how it works. And right, this is also a thing I've come to understand over the past few months, is like, we see everything in the world through a very specific lens, which is really shaped by all of our previous experiences. And depending on where in the world you were born, where you were raised, it has such a big impact, huge impact on how you perceive everything in the world around you. And so when you move from one side of the world to another, or from one culture to another culture, then you suddenly, you just feel at first, because it's going to take some time, but at first you feel like you're totally out of place. Maybe it looks beautiful from a postcard, you know, with the palm trees and the blue sky, and you can eat all the fruit you want that grows there, but it still doesn't feel like you belong there, right? So that is still something that hit me, that the impact of that. And, you know, okay, I've suddenly find myself here on the other side of the world, and I have no, like, we don't know what we're doing, but we're just going with whatever feels right and what feels like we need to do.
And to really resonate in a sense, like as a new dad, you've got a responsibility that you've never held before. And you're like, oh, fuck, you know, I've got my wife to look after. I've got my small baby to care for. Where are we safe? Where are we going to live? How does this work? Presumably you didn't speak a lot of Spanish, and you would have probably had to learn some of that, and just, whoa, like some big calls, like really impressive.
I gotta say, like, nowadays it's a lot easier to move around. You have the internet, you can book everything you want from wherever you are. So the moment you book your plane ticket, you already know where you're going to sleep, you already know where you're going to go. So that makes it so much easier. And then, of course, there are always people along the way that are willing to help you out. So it's not like the, you know, the absolute worst thing that can happen. It's very similar to booking a holiday in that sense. So, and to make it, you know, to rationalize it a little bit more is just to say, like, hey, going on this holiday, we're going on this honeymoon vacation, extended honeymoon for us. And if it doesn't work out, then we'll just return. We'll just go back, or we'd probably go to some other place. And so you want to minimize the amount of movements that you make. So that's also the reason why we first went to Mexico before we went to El Salvador, because we were traveling with two dogs, destinations that were probably going to go in the way that's the practically easiest for us to go. So if we go to El Salvador, because that's the promised Bitcoin land, I want to check it out, but we have to fly through Mexico anyway from Amsterdam, then why not just spend, stop in Mexico, spend some months there, find a good location that could potentially be a nice place to live, and then decide to either, you know, I was always dead set on checking out El Salvador before potentially making any decision. But yeah, that's how it went.
And that's actually a nice segue. So I had a question from the audience, the Bitcoin Bang. He says, please ask him if he would choose Mexico over El Salvador if Mexico made Bitcoin legal tender. So that question dovetails nicely into what you just made the point of. It's like El Salvador was always the target. You decided to pit stop in Mexico. Just explain to us, for the, you know, the people out there that don't understand, why is El Salvador the main target, or why was that the place that you preferred to head to first? And what's the difference between living there and in Mexico?
So why El Salvador was the target? Well, because of the Bitcoin law here in El Salvador. So with the Bitcoin law, coin is accepted as legal tender. And so anywhere in the economy that you want to do a transaction, you want to pay someone, that person is legally obliged to also accept a Bitcoin payment if they are technologically able to do so. So that means that anyone with a smartphone, basically, and internet access has to accept Bitcoin as payment. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that it's enforced and that everyone is actually forced, you know, at gunpoint to accept Bitcoin payments, but it does create a good incentive for most of the big merchants to accept it. And there were also incentives for the population to at least download a Bitcoin wallet that the government made or rolled out and make at least one or two transactions so they could, you know, increase the adoption. And so why I found that interesting from the very get-go, from the day that it was announced at the Bitcoin conference in Miami, is I was looking for a way to contribute to the Bitcoin adoption in the world and education. So moving from a more technologically and more user experience product role at Ledger, I was looking for a way to, you know, dive more into 100% Bitcoin and do that in an autonomous fashion. So I'm working on educational resources that I'm going to launch very soon, and to help people, you know, understand why Bitcoin is necessary and et cetera. So the whole journey from going to understanding it, why is it necessary? How does it work? How do I get some? And how do I secure it? Like the whole journey. So that's going to be my focus. Where would be a better place to do that and to make content, because if you want to, you know, reach people, you need to find good ways to educate or entertain people. And I could find no better way than to actually go to El Salvador and show people what it's like to live here and to show people how Bitcoin works in practice when we try it out on a real scale, on an actual human scale in a full economy like El Salvador's. And I thought I could learn a lot of stuff. I could probably meet a lot of Bitcoiners that were attracted by the same thing. And I think that it's just great if you have that cross-pollination of very, you know, very energetic people, very principled people that are, you know, like myself, hit by various freedom restricting measures all over the world, and they are going somewhere because they want to protect their liberty. That's very radical to do. And so you're probably going to meet a lot of good friends. You're going to make a lot of great connections here by coming to El Salvador. And when I go back to Mexico, obviously there are rumors and there are very concrete movements in the direction of El Salvador. But Mexico is a much larger country, a lot more inhabitants. It's more complex. El Salvador has a very complex, like a very rich history as well. All of the things that have been going on here for the last few decades. But Mexico, it feels like, because it's such a big country, it feels like if you come in there as an individual, it's probably harder to make the right connections, maybe inside of the government. Maybe what I found by living there and by coming down here, the change that has come in El Salvador is so much bigger than what I saw in Mexico, because now you had this country that was totally impoverished and totally controlled by gangs, and the gangs, they are just totally gone now. So can you imagine what it does to a country when suddenly everyone, like all the entrepreneurs, all the people running a business, they are all paying protection money to the gangs. They're under distortion. So they're all paying off the gangs, including the government. And of course, there's a huge amount of corruption in that scenario. And now suddenly you have a leader that comes in, absolute fearless attitude, fearless for his own life, his own family. He comes in and he just cleans the whole mess. And he just puts everyone in prison, and probably also innocent people in prison, unfortunately. But how else are you going to do it? And he just takes care of the problem. And now it's like everyone is super thankful that the crime rate has fallen off a cliff. Everyone can feel it in their pockets because, like, suddenly there's investments coming in. But not only that, suddenly the people don't have to pay off any gang members anymore for their protection. So everyone has more to spend. And that's just great. You go from a place where I was in Europe, where people are super pessimistic about the future. And now you drop into a place where everyone can't believe the luck they have that suddenly things are changing for the better and they can only see their situation improving. Wow. Different than in Mexico, where you still have lots of areas which are controlled by, I wouldn't say gangs, but by the cartels. In Mexico, yeah. Right. So in Mexico, you have big parts of Mexico which are still controlled by cartels, and where if you wanted to open a restaurant, let's say, you would still have to pay them off, and you would pay taxes to the cartel, and you would pay tax to the government.
Mm. So it's like not the same. Another example that springs to mind is just the remittance problem that Bitcoin solves. And I interviewed a guy called Lord Fosatua. Shout out to the Lord if he's ever listening, but he's from Tonga, and the Tonga GDP is about $500 million. And about 30% of your $100, when you try and send it from Sydney to Tonga, it disappears to Western Union. So with their GDP of $500 million largely coming from remittance, so half of their economy is remittance cash, with 30% less fees, they can basically add a quarter of the 25% more GDP to their bottom line. Like, it's a radical change in prosperity potential for a place. So it's just another example of where Bitcoin's playing all sorts of amazing games in a way. How fascinating. And so as a young European family in El Salvador, how's it been making new friends? And have you, you know, do you love the move? Is the potential to stay there for multiple years? Or how are you kind of thinking about the near term?
So I like to be very balanced about my views, because it all depends. Like, I can only talk from my own perspective. Someone asked me about my experience. I got to preface by saying, like, this is very personal and it's my perspective. It is very based on my previous experiences as a European living in the Netherlands, France, Spain, Portugal. And if you're coming from another country, let's say the United States, and you're used to an environment where it's normal to take the car to go practically everywhere, then it's not going to be such a big culture shock when you come down here and you realize that, oh, I need the car to go, you know, shopping, I need the car to go to the gym, I need the car to do anything basically in my life. So from my personal experience, like, there have been absolute things that I don't like here and that don't make it the perfect environment for me. But I still think when I take all of the pluses and minuses, it's still the balance still is positive for me and my family. It has taken us quite some time to, you know, get used to certain things, know where to find certain, you know, items that we want, that we think we need, like that we want organic produce. Now, in a country which is much poorer than where we come from, there's not such a big demand for those kinds of products. So that means that you have to go out of your way to find the people that can deliver to you, right? It's not like you're going to the supermarket and you can find anything non-organic and you can find it organic too, right? Like we were used to in Europe, we could find anything. And then you come to appreciate the amount of convenience that you have in developed markets and where people are relatively wealthy and they can afford very convenient like lifestyles. You know, you get things delivered to your doorstep. Mm-hmm. You need this electronic device. Okay, you can have it tomorrow. And here it's so now suddenly it's so much different. But that's going to change because this market is suddenly opening up. There's more investment coming in. Of course, it has all to do with the president and the crime rate dropping. And so this country is going to develop at a very rapid pace. But that doesn't mean that today we have everything that we would like to have. On the other hand, we live in a it's beautiful here in the climate. We absolutely love the climate. We don't have to think about what we're going to wear for 1 second of the day because it's always hot out there. You barely wear any clothes, like you wear shorts and then a shirt or no shirt. I put on a shirt for the podcast. So it's super, super convenient. And we live plant-based, so we eat a ton of fruit, and the fruit here is of amazing quality. You're not going to find these avocados in Northern America because they have to get, you know, shipped. They have to get treated in all sorts of ways. So I could go down an entire list of all the things I like and dislike. But my takeaway would be that the only way to find out as an individual would be to come down here and spend the time. And there's no way that a YouTube video or a blog post is going to tell you all of the things that you need to know because you're watching that piece of content through the lens of someone else, which isn't necessarily your lens. Mm-hmm. So unless you can find someone that is very similar in lifestyle and values and principles that is making that specific piece of content and telling you about what it's like to live there, you're not going to find out unless you actually go there.
It's a great point, actually. And so it's the same with really consuming any content, isn't it? You have to kind of almost pinch yourself for a second, just remember, like, okay, well, this is someone's view. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's your own. So one question that is probably pretty obvious to answer, but there's a beautiful angle of digital assets from the perspective of mobility, right? So you don't have a cafe, you don't have a factory, you don't have some kind of physical business. You can own your wealth online and you can go wherever you want, whenever you want, in theory. Quit your job, you've moved to a different part of the world. Like, how do you pay the bills? Like, there are some costs that would come up. Is that just from previous savings, or is it because Bitcoin has moved up? Like, there'll be lots of people out there that are in a fixed employment contract that are looking at all these problems they see around and thinking, fuck, what am I going to do about this? But they feel tied into their current world for whatever reason. Just from a kind of financial freedom perspective, like, how does that work?
I mean, if you stack sats and you buy Bitcoin with every, like, if you live a very frugal life and you stack sats with everything that you can set aside and you do that for a certain number of years and you take good care of your security and you don't do any like gambling with your savings, then just very small amounts of Bitcoin over time, like regularly saved, can quickly add up to a meaningful amount that will enable you to, you know, make certain decisions in your life, like quitting your job, and it doesn't mean that from one day to another you're a millionaire or anything, but it gives you a little bit of a cushion, a little bit of savings that you can rely on, and if you're confident that you can, you know, have a certain amount of time without steady income, that you'll be okay. Now, of course, that's easier said than done because as Bitcoiners, you want to save as much as you can and you want to keep as much as you can in Bitcoin. But Bitcoin is extremely volatile. So you've got to be honest and responsible for yourself and say, okay, how much risk do I need to take with those savings? If I'm going to be dependent on it for the next year or 18 months, whatever it is, do I need to set that aside in dirty fiat? Because if, you know, suddenly the price crashes, am I, you know, suddenly going to have to go back to work and give back some of the freedom that I took by quitting my job, by taking another job that I don't want, but I need to support myself? And I got caught off guard by the move in the Bitcoin market for sure. And I think many of us were, where we were absolutely counting on a, you know, a repeat of the cycle. You get this blow off top and you have a lot of margin, and it's easy to recognize when you're at the peak of the bubble in the mania phase. And we turned out in this past cycle that we are much earlier at that point than we all thought we were. So I took a lot of lessons there, and I would now do things differently. It's learning the lessons, and then, you know, I think moving forward, I'll be more robust in the sense that I'll take less risk, and I have to think about my personal situation where I'm responsible for a wife and a young kid. Mm-hmm. And if you're alone, then you can probably afford to take more risk than I can currently. Yeah, that's how I would answer that. So yeah, savings and very frugal lifestyle, yeah, for years, and that can get you a long way.
And it drives another question into my mind, which is, you know, what is wealth? And the ability to not be in a fixed term employment contract. And yes, you are having to spend some sats in the short mm-hmm. term in order to not mm-hmm. have that kind of commitment, mm-hmm. your time tied up with someone else. Like, that's actually very, very valuable to, like, yes, be in charge of your own mm-hmm. time. So mm-hmm. after 4 years of being with Ledger, you said, fuck this, I'm going to go off and do my own thing. How did that feel? And what is wealth?
Yeah, so wealth is, it comes down to, you know, that idea of freedom, of being able to spend your time however you choose to, with whomever you choose to, in whatever way you choose to, and at the location that you desire. And money is a tool, wealth is a tool to enable you to do that. So I disagree with my parents that used to say that money is not important. I think money is very much important, and you need money for most of the important things in your life, including taking care of others, including taking care of yourself. And it's simply a form of energy. And if you get to accumulate enough energy, and then you get to spend it and spend your own time in whatever way you choose, and hopefully use that time that you've, you know, saved by saving hard money, now you have suddenly a bunch of time, you can release yourself from the commitment of, you know, going to a job every day, then you hopefully can invest that wealth and maybe build up something of your own, or, you know, invest in another project that's not your own, but someone else is doing. And so wealth is, I think, is being able to at some point make sure that wealth keeps growing because you're investing it in a productive way. It's not just, oh, okay, I'm rich now, I'm going to go to the beach and, you know, just stay in the sun all day and swim in the ocean. I think that gets very, very boring very quickly. And I could never imagine, you know, retiring. This whole concept of, you know, stopping working on anything that is productive or interesting. You don't need to make money off of it, but just, you know, retiring and then going to do cruises or whatever. You know, it's like I don't get the concept of that. So I don't
We're
save
in the
for
same
retirement.
In that sense.
Yeah. I think I would always keep looking for passions and new things to learn, and especially hang out with young people. Like I think the most interesting older people are those that hang out with young people. They stay very young. They stay very fresh, and they keep learning, basically.
And David, the truth is, we're very, very lucky. So you and I are both into Bitcoin in such a way that if it transpires as we expect, when we mm-hmm. turn 65, you know, there'll be no way, in my mind anyway, that we won't be able to choose where we are, who we're with, and what we're doing with mm-hmm. our time. If anything, mm-hmm. that might happen before we turn 40, like truly, truly happen. You know, you might have to be worrying about, you know, being super frugal, for example, or whatever other area of your life that might alter as a result of a $1 million Bitcoin. But equally, these big price targets, no one has a fucking clue what's going to happen. And it never translates into what you can actually buy for that. So it might be $1 million a coin, but if it costs you, you know, $999,000 to leave your front door, then it doesn't matter whether that, you know, is buying organic produce. Like here in Australia, we buy organic as well. And that's a whole other rabbit hole in itself in terms of the health impacts of chemical fertilizers all over your food. I mean, it's fucking madness, to be honest. But you suddenly realize that, like, our shopping weekly has gone up like a drastic amount in the last year, but no one's seeing that on CPI, like even though it's at 10%. I mean, that's a whole other kind of macro discussion, but there's a very exciting time ahead. Well, so the last question I have for you is a bit of a boring one, but in terms of the actual process of being in El Salvador, so what kind of visa do you get as a young European family, and how's that process? Mm-hmm.
So there are different types of visas you can get. It really depends on your situation. A popular one that a lot of people choose to opt for is it's kind of called the digital nomad visa. It's not really called that in the law, but that's what it's referred to. And it basically means that you need to have a certain amount of monthly income from an online employment, like, and then you can qualify for that. And there are definitely ways, like it's more accessible than you might think. And there, I recommend everyone that's like looking into that and can really considering doing something like that is to just look for a good lawyer that can help you with that. Yeah, my takeaway from it is that it's more accessible than I originally thought it was going to be.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Another conversation I'm having with the Bitcoin world that I will be trying to translate to my wife to work out, you know, what the hell we want to do. So we'll see where that takes us. Well, David, thank you so much for your time today.
But there's a good piece of news that very recently came in, and that is that the tourist card, the validity of it is now extended to 180 days. So it used to be 90 days. Mm. Now it's 180 days, which is the same as in Mexico. So you could actually do 6 months in Mexico as a tourist and then come to El Salvador 6 months as a tourist. Wow. So you wouldn't have to worry for a while about getting residency.
And so let's just put that action, that rough plan in place. So if you were a tourist in Mexico for 6 months, then a tourist in El Salvador for 6 months, things like income tax don't exist, right? You don't pay, you'd be essentially a non-domiciled tax resident in the world. So you wouldn't have that kind of concern to worry about. And equally, is there a capital gains tax on Bitcoin in Mexico?
I mean, it does mean that you would have to...
You also have to move the whole time with small babies. It's not feasible.
I'm saying you do need to make sure that you're not registered anymore as a tax resident in your country of origin. In that
yes.
way, right? So you're totally like removing all traces. But legally, the place where you're... spending more than 180 days, that's going to be your tax residency normally, right? But it depends. Like all of the countries have different tax laws. I'm not an expert on that. So it's not something I have to worry about just yet, maybe in a while as I spin up my business. But yeah, it's interesting to look at all the ways you can arbitrage different countries, Mexico versus El Salvador, and there are a bunch of other
vice versa
as well.
And equally, like, so my wife's Australian, I'm English. If, you know, I would envisage potentially a scenario where, you know, you could spend 90 days in England, you could spend 90 days in Australia and 6 months in El Salvador, and you wouldn't be required to pay income tax anywhere.
Yeah, but things get very complicated when you add kids to the mix. Because
of
kids
course
do
it
like
is, mate. And that's why it's been so interesting to hear your story, because you're actually in El Salvador with a small baby. No, you don't want to buy yourself more problems. And I'm not necessarily like someone who's looking to evade tax. I'm happy to pay it where I see fit, but it becomes more egregious every year, and you go, what am I paying for? And that's probably one of the reasons why you left, you know.
It's good if we become more like a customer, right? Where we can, you know, we can shop around and we can choose where we get treated the best and where we pay the least for that treatment. And hopefully those incentives will somehow improve the overall landscape of taxation and the government services.
I'm confident that will happen over time. But in the meantime, the ability to vote with your feet is the most important factor, I think, in actually happening. Like El Salvador 3 years ago, no one had talked about it internationally for a huge amount of time. And look at the progress that's been made there. It's quite incredible to think how much, like I saw a report relatively recently, which talked about the boost in tourism in El Salvador has had like a very real impact. And you think, how many other countries are in a similar situation globally that might look to do something similar? And there will be loads, I'm sure. Anyway, David, so thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you telling your story, and thank you for joining the podcast. Last question, where can people reach out to get in touch?
All right, well, it was an absolute pleasure. I had a ton of fun recording with you, Jake. People can find me on Twitter mostly. My handle is at DL Da Silva Rosa. And otherwise, I'm also on YouTube. I have put up a few YouTube videos. Just type my name, David Da Silva Rosa. It's also linked from my Twitter account.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, friends, nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best, Jake.